After 1985, the CIA also supplied electronic timing and detonation devices that made it easier to set off explosions from a remote location. The most basic delay detonator was the time pencil, a chemical device that wore down gradually and set off a bomb or rocket after a predictable period. It had been developed by the CIA's Office of Technical Services. Guerrillas could use these devices to set an explosive charge at night, retreat, and then watch it blow up at first light. After 1985, the CIA also shipped in E-cell delay detonators, which used sophisticated electronics to achieve similar effects. Thousands of the delay timers were distributed on the frontier. Speaking in an interview in July 1992, 7 months before the first Islamist terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, a U.S. official closely involved in the CIA supply program was asked by the author to estimate the amount of plastic explosives that had been transferred by Pakistani intelligence to the Mujahideen with CIA and Saudi support. The official spontaneously chose these words: "We could have probably blown up half of New York with the explosives that the PAKs supplied." CIA lawyers and operators at Langley were more sensitive than ever about second-guessing from Congress and the press. Casey's Nicaragua operations were going sour just as the covert Afghan war began to escalate. The agency was criticized sharply for placing mines in Nicaragua's harbors. There was a feeling taking hold in the Directorate of Operations by late 1985 that perhaps Casey had gone too far, that the agency was headed for another political crash. In the Afghan program, the CIA was now supplying many dual-use weapons systems, meaning weapons that could be used against legitimate military targets, but also could be employed in terrorism or assassination. These included the new electronic detonators, the malleable plastic explosives, and sniper rifle packages. The rough rule at Langley was that the CIA would not supply any weapon where its most likely use would be for assassination or criminal enterprise, as one official involved put it. Since the CIA was not running the commando operations itself, but was relying on Pakistani intelligence, most likely use could only be approximated. Langley's Afghan task force chief, the rough and aggressive anti-communist Gust Avrogatos, tried to evade CIA lawyers. "These aren't terrorist devices or assassination techniques," Avrogatos told his colleagues, when weapons such as sniper rifles had to be described in cables and memos. "Henceforth, these are individual defensive devices." He discouraged officers from putting too much in writing. When the Islamabad station sent a cable describing a borderline guerrilla tactic, he wrote back that the message had been garbled and that the station should not send anything more on that subject ever again. He shopped in Egypt for sabotage devices such as wheelbarrows rigged as bombs that could be used to target Soviet officers in Kabul. "Do I want to order bicycle bombs to park in front of an officer's headquarters?" Avrogatos recalled asking. "Yes. That's what spreads fear." He endorsed a system run by Pakistani intelligence that rewarded Afghan commanders for the number of individual Soviet belt buckles they brought in. American law about assassination and terrorism was entering another of its periods of flux. The executive order banning assassination, enacted by President Ford in response to the exposure of CIA plots from the 1960s, had been sitting unexamined on the books for a decade. Not even the hardliners in the Reagan cabinet wanted the ban removed, but they had begun to question its ambiguities. When did targeting a general or head of state in war or in response to a terrorist attack drift across the line and become assassination? Was the decision to target that general or head of state the issue, or was it the means employed to kill him? What if a preemptive assassination was undertaken to stop a terrorist from attacking the United States? The questions being debated were both strategic and pragmatic. For American national security, what policy was morally defensible and militarily effective? What, technically, did the Ford-era assassination ban cover? This had to be spelled out, CIA officers argued, or else agents and even civilian policymakers might inadvertently expose themselves to criminal prosecution. Reagan's lawyers at the White House and the Justice Department believed that preemptive attacks on individuals carried out in self-defense, such as against a terrorist about to launch a strike, were clearly legal. But there were many questions about how such a standard should be defined and implemented. In the Afghan program, sniper rifles created the greatest unease. They were known as buffalo guns and could accurately fire large, potent bullets from distances of 1 or 2 kilometers. The idea to supply them to the Afghan rebels had originated with a special forces enthusiast in Washington named Vaughn Forrest, who wrote a long report for the CIA and the National Security Council about how the Mujahideen might counter Soviet Spetsnaz tactics by hitting Soviet commanders directly. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that you need to hit them hard, you need to hit them deep, and you need to hit his heart and brains, Forrest said. His enthusiasm extended to a broader campaign of urban sabotage that some on the NSC Interagency Committee regarded as outright terrorism. But the idea of targeting Soviet commanders with the sniper rifles found support. The phrase, shooting ducks in a barrel, was used, one participant recalled. The sniper program's advocate wanted to off Russian generals in series. Through the CIA station in Islamabad, Pakistani intelligence endorsed a formal written request for the buffalo guns, plus supporting equipment such as night vision goggles and high-powered scopes that would allow a shooter to hit his target from a mile away under cover of darkness. The incoming cable set off alarms in the General Counsel's office at the CIA. The night vision equipment and scopes were clearly intended for missions that, if not outright assassination under the law, seemed uncomfortably close. Should the operation go sour, the Islamabad station chief might end up in handcuffs. After several rounds of debate and teeth-gnashing, a compromise was reached. The guns could be shipped to Pakistan, but they would be stripped of the night vision goggles and scopes that seemed to tilt their most likely use toward assassination. Also, the CIA would not provide ISI with target intelligence from satellites concerning where Soviet officers lived or how their apartment buildings might be approached stealthily. CIA officers tried to emphasize to ISI the guns' value as anti-material weapons, meaning that they could be used to shoot out the tires in a convoy of trucks from a distant mountaintop or to drill holes in a fuel tanker. American specialists traveled to Pakistan to train ISI officers on the rifles so that they, in turn, could train rebel commando teams. In the end, dozens of the sniper rifles were shipped to Afghanistan. The terrorist attacks came one after another during 1985, all broadcast live on network television to tens of millions of Americans. In June, 2 Lebanese terrorists hijacked TWA Flight 847, murdered a Navy diver on board, and negotiated while mugging for cameras on a Beirut runway. In October, the Palestinian terrorist Abu Abbas hijacked the cruise ship Achille Lauro in Italy, murdered a 69-year-old Jewish-American tourist Leon Klinghoffer, dumped his body overboard, and ultimately escaped to Baghdad with Egyptian and Italian collaboration. Just after Christmas, Palestinian gunmen with the Abu Nidal organization opened fire on passengers lined up at El Al ticket counters in Vienna and Rome, killing 19 people, among them 5 Americans. One of the American victims was an 11-year-old girl named Natasha Simpson, who died in her father's arms after a gunman unloaded an extra round in her head, just to make sure. The attackers, boyish products of Palestinian refugee camps, had been pumped full of amphetamines by their handlers just before the holiday attacks. The shock of these events followed the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, which claimed the lives of some of the CIA's brightest minds on the Middle East, and the bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, in which 241 Marines died. The Shiite terrorist organization Hezbollah had seized American hostages in Lebanon. Casey and Reagan had been galvanized by this violence in Lebanon against official Americans and journalists. Now they confronted a new, wider wave of attacks targeting American civilians and tourists. During 1985, about 6.5 million Americans traveled overseas, of whom about 6,000 died for various reasons, mainly from illnesses. 17 were killed by terrorists. Yet by the end of the year, millions of Americans were canceling travel plans and demanding action from their government. Palestinian and Lebanese Shiite terrorists had captured America's attention just as they had hoped to do.
"When we hijack a plane, it has more effect than if we killed 100 Israelis in battle," the Palestinian Marxist leader George Habash once said. "At least the world is talking about us now."
By the mid-1980s, the American analyst Brian Jenkins's observation had become famous. "Terrorists want a lot of people watching, and a lot of people listening, and not a lot of people dead." He coined another oft-repeated phrase. "Terrorism is theater." In its modern form, it was a theater invented largely by a stateless Palestinian diaspora whose leftist leaders sought dramatic means to attract attention to their national claims. In the new academic specialty of terrorist studies, it was common to date the first modern terrorist event as the Habash-led hijacking of an El Al flight from Rome to Tel Aviv on July 22, 1968. Thereafter, inventive Palestinian terrorists attacked the vulnerabilities of aviation and exploited the new global reach of television, creating a succession of made-for-TV terrorist events that emphasized the spectacular. At the same time, because a purpose of their movement was to negotiate for statehood, they often sought to limit and calibrate their violence to create the greatest impact without alienating important political allies. As at the Munich Olympics in 1972 and at the Rome and Vienna airports in late 1985, these efforts to control public relations sometimes failed. In Washington especially, the politics of anti-terrorism were becoming angrier and angrier. Shortly after the airport attacks, Casey summoned the chief of the CIA's European division, Duane R. Dewey Claridge, to his office on Langley's 7th floor. A New Hampshire Yankee educated at Brown University, Claridge was a cigar-chomping career officer who craved action and bridled at supervision. He had served in Nepal and India during the early Cold War, running anti-Soviet operations on obscure frontiers. He had impressed Casey as a hardy risk-taker, and the director rewarded him with full control over his secret war in Nicaragua. There, Claridge pushed the operation to the limits, running speedy Q-boats to smuggle guns and plant mines. When his harbor mining operations created a congressional uproar, Casey moved Claridge to the European division in the Directorate of Operations. Now the director wanted his help again. Reagan was putting intense pressure on the CIA to show more initiative in the fight against terrorism, Casey told Claridge. The director wanted to reply by forming action teams that could put the CIA on the offensive in a global campaign against terrorist groups. Claridge told Casey what the director already believed. To succeed, the CIA had to attack the terrorist cells preemptively. If not, the incidents would become bolder, bloodier, and more numerous. Casey erupted in a sudden burst of animation and told Claridge to interview terrorism specialists around Washington and write up a proposal for a new covert CIA counter-terrorist strategy. Claridge found an office down the hall and started work just after New Year's Day, 1986. By late January, Claridge had drafted his blueprint, an 8- or 9-page double-spaced memo addressed to Casey. The CIA had several problems in confronting the global terrorist threat, Claridge wrote. The biggest was its defensive mentality. Terrorists operated worldwide, knowing there was little chance of retribution or of their being brought to justice. Claridge wanted a new legal operating system for the CIA that would allow offensive strikes against terrorists. He proposed the formation of two super-secret action teams that would be funded and equipped to track, attack, and snatch terrorists globally. The action teams would be authorized to kill terrorists if doing so would preempt a terrorist event, or arrest them and bring them to justice, if possible. One action team would be made up of foreign nationals who could blend more easily into landscapes overseas. The other action team would be Americans. Claridge wrote that the CIA's regional directorates, with their strict geographical borders, were a poor match for the international mobility of terrorist groups, especially the stateless Palestinians. Terrorism, Claridge thought, never fits one particular piece of real estate. It is effective precisely because it spreads all over the map. Not only the CIA, but the government is not organized as a whole to really deal with transnational problems. He proposed a new interdisciplinary center at the CIA, global in reach, to be called the Counterterrorists Center, a fusion center that would combine resources from different directorates and break down the agency's walls. The new center would be located within the Directorate of Operations, but would include analysts from the Directorate of Intelligence and tinkerers from the Directorate of Science and Technology. This would be a sharp break from traditional agency organization, where action-oriented spies in the Directorate of Operations were separated physically, by bars in some parts of the Langley compound, from the agency's analysts in the Directorate of Intelligence who wrote reports and forecasts. The separation helped protect the identities of espionage sources, clandestine service officers believed. But over the years, the division had become calcified and unexamined. The memo stirred sharp opposition from the Directorate of Operations. Among other things, its officers feared the new center would poach resources and talent. Some spies in the DO sniffed at counterterrorism operations as police work best left to cops or the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But Robert Gates, then running the Directorate of Intelligence, weighed in to support Claridge's ideas, and Casey lined up too. The CIA's Counterterrorist Center was born on February 1, 1986. Claridge was named its first director. Claridge helped draft a new, highly classified presidential finding on terrorism, authorizing covert action by the CIA against terrorist groups worldwide. It was signed by Reagan at the time of the center's birth, along with a broader policy document, National Security Decision Directive 207, the National Program for Combating Terrorism, classified top secret. The covert action finding was developed through an interagency committee on terrorism formed at the National Security Council. The new NSC committee, under various names, would become the main locus for presidential decision-making about terrorism for years to come. Its founding directive highlighted counterterrorism questions that would surface repeatedly in the years ahead. Was terrorism a law enforcement problem or a national security issue? Should the CIA try to capture terrorists alive in order to try them on criminal charges in open courts, or should the goal be to bring them back in body bags? The policies set out in NSDD 207 came down on both sides of these questions. Yes, in some cases terrorism was a law enforcement problem, but in others it should be handled as a military matter. Terrorists should be captured for trial when possible, but that would not always be a requirement. The initial draft finding authorized the new action teams Claridge and Casey sought, and it permitted the CIA to undertake secret operations to defeat terrorism, both on its own and in liaison with foreign governments. The purpose of such covert action would be to detect, disrupt, and preempt terrorist strikes. This could include capturing terrorists for trial, or striking militarily if the enemy were on the verge of launching a terrorist operation. Claridge interpreted the new finding as authority to do pretty much anything he wanted against the terrorists, recalled Robert Baer, one of the center's early recruits from the Directorate of Operations. But the proposed action teams, particularly the one to be composed of foreigners, stirred nervous reaction on Capitol Hill. Some privately labeled them hit teams. The CIA and the NSC had to brief the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence about the new presidential finding. Robert Gates recalled going to a Secure Hill hearing room for one such session. "And we got to the question of when you could kill a terrorist, and we had this almost theological argument. Well, if the guy is driving toward the barracks with a truck full of explosives, can you kill him? Yeah. Well, what if he's in his apartment putting the explosives together? Well, I don't know." It was a debate that would continue more or less in that form and largely unresolved for the next 15 years, until the morning of September 11, 2001. The Counterterrorist Center took life on Langley's sixth floor in a burst of pure frenetic energy, Baer recalled. Everyone worked in one huge open bay, with the telephones ringing nonstop, printers clattering, files stacked all over the place, CNN playing on TV monitors bolted to the ceiling, hundreds of people in motion and at their computers. It gave the impression of a war room. But as the political and legal scandals surrounding Casey's adventures in Nicaragua and Iran swelled across Washington during 1986, the original war room vision for action teams and an offensive posture yielded to a more cautious, analytical, report-writing culture than Casey and Claridge had originally imagined. Casey had envisaged it as something different than what it eventually became, recalled Vincent Canestrero, who arrived as an operations officer soon after the center's founding. The Iran-Contra scandal had involved disclosures of illegal support by Oliver North, Casey, and other policymakers for Nicaraguan rebels, as well as illegal shipments of missiles to Iran in an effort to free the American hostages in Lebanon. In the aftermath, Casey, of course, was looked on as an adventurer, and Dewey as kind of a cowboy, Canestrero said. The appetite for risk-taking within the center and on the Hill oversight committees waned rapidly. Still, Claridge remained in charge, and he began to push his colleagues. Secular leftist groups carried out the most visible terrorist strikes in 1985 and 1986. Some of these groups advocated a nationalist cause, the Palestinian terrorists, the Irish Republican Army, the Basque separatists. Others chased more abstract Marxist revolutionary goals, such as Germany's Bader-Meinhof gang and Italy's Red Brigades. Most case officers and analysts at the CIA saw fewer direct links between the Soviet Union and these secular leftist terrorists than Casey did. Still, all these terrorists openly described themselves as vanguards in the left-right ideological struggle of the Cold War. Claridge opened terrorism-focused liaisons with security services across Europe, providing technological help where possible, such as beacons that he inserted into planted weapons to help track the locations of Basque separatist cells in Spain. The CIA's officers and their counterparts in Europe had long experience with these kinds of groups. They understood their mindsets. In some cases, they had attended the same universities as the radicals. They knew how to talk to them, how to recruit them, how to corrupt them. At its start, the Counterterrorist Center concentrated heavily on these leftist terrorists. The center was organized into subunits that targeted particular groups. One of the largest units focused on the Abu Nidal organization, which had claimed hundreds of civilian lives in multiple strikes during the 1980s. Claridge and his colleagues decided to sow dissent by exposing the group's financial operations and trying to raise suspicions among members. Abu Nidal had become a paranoid, self-immolating group on its own accord, but the agency helped accelerate its breakup through penetrations and disinformation. Abu Nidal faded as an effective terrorist organization within 3 years. There were other successes, especially in Germany and Italy, where the terrorists began to consume themselves, sometimes helped along by covert operations. Hezbollah, on the other hand, proved a very hard target. It was the new center's first attempt to penetrate a committed Islamist terrorist organization that targeted American citizens. The experience offered ill omens for the future. A radical Islamic Shiite faction in Lebanon's civil war that began to serve as a proxy force for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, Hezbollah had become a terrorist branch of the still-churning Iranian Revolution. The CIA had no sources in Hezbollah's leadership. Hezbollah's pious members did not hang out in the hotels and salons that made Abu Nidal members such accessible targets. The CIA's unilateral resources in the Middle East were spread thin. Baer was one of only two Arabic speakers in the counterterrorist center at the time it was launched. For a full year after Hezbollah kidnapped and tortured the CIA's Beirut station chief, William Buckley, beginning in 1984, the agency had absolutely no idea who had taken him or the other American hostages in Lebanon, Baer recalled. Meanwhile, the counterterrorist center had to deal with hoax after hoax, some mounted by Hezbollah as disinformation, about where the hostages were located. Claridge wanted to attack. He sought to enlist U.S. special forces to launch an elaborate hostage rescue operation in Beirut. He rigged up special refrigerator trucks in Europe, disguised to look as if they belonged to Lebanese merchants. He hoped they could be shipped in and used to run Delta Force commandos into West Beirut. But the Pentagon's generals, citing weak intelligence about where the hostages were actually being held, said they would not launch such an operation unless there were American eyes on the target, confirming the presence of hostages 24 hours before the operation began. They would not trust a Lebanese or other Arab spotter. They wanted an American in place. Claridge had no obvious way to infiltrate an American agent into West Beirut. The counterterrorist center trained a Filipino-born Delta Force soldier for insertion in disguise into Beirut, in the hope that he might be able to provide the required American eyes on the target. But that high-risk operation foundered. The center was totally incapable of collecting real-time intelligence on Hezbollah because, one, we didn't understand it, recalled Canestrero. We understood secular terrorism, radical terrorism. These were people we were comfortable with. Claridge wondered if technology might not solve the problem that human intelligence seemed unable to crack. He loved the counterterrorist center's engineers on the science and technology side. They took what Claridge liked to call a Radio Shack approach to problem solving. Claridge commissioned them to work on a highly classified, pilotless drone equipped with intercept equipment, an infrared camera, and low-noise wooden propellers. It might fly overhead at about 2,500 feet and locate the American hostages. He spent $7 million on 5 prototypes in what he dubbed the Eagle program. Another use for the drones might be sabotage operations in Libya. Claridge wanted to load one drone with 200 pounds of C4 plastic explosives and 100 pounds of ball bearings. His plan was to fly it onto Tripoli's airfield at night, blow it up, and destroy a whole bunch of commercial airliners sitting unoccupied on the ground. He also tried to load small rockets onto the drones that could be used to fire at pre-designated targets. But all of the technology was in its infancy, and Claridge made some of his colleagues very nervous, especially in the era of Iran-Contra. Claridge wanted to kill the terrorists outright. He found the American government's position against assassination of leaders who sponsored terrorism to be hypocritical. The president would authorize the military to carry out air attacks that may or may not hit and kill the real target, but would not authorize the counterterrorist center to stealthily assassinate the same man. He asked, "Why is an expensive military raid with heavy collateral damage to our allies and to innocent children okay? More morally acceptable than a bullet to the head." By early 1986, Brigadier Youssef had constructed a large and sophisticated secret infrastructure for guerrilla training along the Afghan frontier. Between 16,000 and 18,000 fresh recruits passed through his camps and training courses each year. He also began to facilitate independent guerrilla and sabotage training by Afghan rebel parties outside of ISI control. From 6,000 to 7,000 jihadists trained this way each year, Youssef later estimated. Some of these were Arab volunteers. The syllabus offered by Pakistani intelligence became more specialized. New Mujahideen recruits entered a 2 to 3 week basic training course where they learned how to maneuver and fire an assault rifle. The best were then selected for graduate courses in more complex weapons and tactics. Youssef established specialized training camps for explosives work, urban sabotage and car bombing, anti-aircraft weapons, sniper rifles, and landmines. Thousands of new graduates, the great majority Afghans, but also now some Algerians, Palestinians, Tunisians, Saudi Arabians, and Egyptians, fanned out across Afghanistan as mountain snows melted in the spring of 1986 and a new fighting season began. Across the Afghan border, they established new camps in rock valleys and captured government garrisons. This allowed them to continue training on their own, to recruit new fighters, and to refine the sabotage and guerrilla techniques taught by Pakistani intelligence. Terrorism is often confused or equated with guerrilla warfare, the terrorism theorist Bruce Hoffman once wrote. This is not surprising, since guerrillas often employ the same tactics, assassination, kidnapping, bombings of public gathering places, hostage-taking, etc., for the same purposes, to intimidate or coerce, thereby affecting behavior through the arousal of fear, as terrorists. 10 years later, The vast training infrastructure that Yusuf and his colleagues built with the enormous budgets endorsed by NSDD 166, the specialized camps, the sabotage training manuals, the electronic bomb detonators, and so on, would be referred to routinely in America as terrorist infrastructure. At the time of its construction, however, it served a jihadist army that operated openly on the battlefield, attempted to seize and hold territory, and exercised sovereignty over civilian populations. They pursued a transparent national cause. By 1986, however, that Afghan cause entangled increasingly with the international Islamist networks, whose leaders had a more ambitious goal, the toppling of corrupt and anti-religious governments across the Islamic world. In its first years, the CIA's new counter-terrorist center placed virtually no emphasis on the Muslim Brotherhood-inspired networks. After Abu Nidal and Hezbollah, the center's next largest branches all focused on secular leftist terrorist groups. These included multiple Palestinian groups, Marxist-Leninist terrorists in Europe, the Shining Path in Peru, and the Japanese Red Army. Continued ferment in Tehran generated fears among CIA analysts that other weak Middle Eastern regimes might succumb to Islamic revolt. But now more than 6 years had passed since the Iranian Revolution, and no other similar insurgency had yet erupted. There were stirrings of religious dissent in places such as Algeria and a few Islamist bombings in France. Britain's MI6, concerned about rising Islamic radicalism, commissioned a retired Arabist spy to travel for months through the Muslim world from Morocco to Indonesia, to write a detailed report about contemporary Islamism on the street and in the mosques. But these were minor efforts that attracted little attention within the CIA or outside it. There was one other small blip on the counter-terrorist center's screen. From Pakistan arrived reports of a new group called the Islamic Salvation Foundation that had been formed in Peshawar to recruit and support Arab volunteers for the Afghan jihad, outside the control of any of the ISI-backed rebel parties. The network was operating offices and guest houses along the Afghan frontier. Osama bin Laden, a wealthy young Saudi, was spreading large sums of money around Peshawar to help the new center expand. He was tapping into ISI's guerrilla training camps on behalf of newly arrived Arab jihadists. The early reports of his activity that were passed along to the CIA's counter-terrorist center in this period suggested that bin Laden certainly was not engaged in any fighting. He was not a warrior, recalled Stanley Beddington, a senior analyst at the center from its beginning. Still, when a man starts throwing around money like that, he comes to your notice. When they first learned of efforts by bin Laden and allied Islamic proselytizers to increase the number of Arab volunteers fighting the Soviets, some of the most ardent cold warriors at Langley thought this program should be formally endorsed and expanded. The more committed anti-Soviet fighters, the better, they argued. As more and more Arabs arrived in Pakistan during 1985 and 1986, the CIA examined ways to increase their participation, perhaps in the form of some sort of international brigade, but nothing came of it, Robert Gates recalled. At CIA headquarters, Osama bin Laden was little more than a name in a file for now. But in tumultuous Peshawar, he had begun to organize his own escalation of the Afghan war. 8. Inshallah, you will know my plans. Milton Bearden replaced William Pikeney as CIA station chief in Islamabad in July 1986. A large-boned, heavy-set, boyish-faced, slang-slinging Texan who aspired to novel writing and seemed to conduct himself as if his life were a Hollywood casting call, Bearden had drawn close to Casey a few years earlier when he was station chief in Khartoum, Sudan. There he had smuggled besieged Israeli intelligence officers out of the country in crates labeled as diplomatic mail, just the sort of dashing operation Casey loved. When Casey traveled in Africa in his blackened Starlifter, Bearden was his escort to late-night meetings with murderous intelligence chiefs. They were both romantics who reveled in the spy's life. The CIA director needed someone who could manage the massive escalation he had helped set in motion in Afghanistan. He called Bearden into his seventh-floor office at Langley and told him the new policy. I want you to go out there and win. Bearden understood that Casey had a giant vision of global struggle against the Soviet Union through covert action, and that Afghanistan was a little part of it. Yet Casey made clear that he saw this last push along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border as an urgent moral mission. As Bearden saw it, Casey believed that sacrificing Afghan lives without pursuing total victory over the communists was a strategy for small minds. Casey was the best and worst director the CIA had ever known, Bearden thought. Inside the Directorate of Operations, Bearden was a popular figure. Uncle Milty, an indulgent boss, an operator's operator, full of humor and bluster. He landed in hot, shapeless Islamabad, charged by Casey's ambition. The station on the embassy's rebuilt third floor was still modest in size compared to the amount of money and paperwork it now handled. Bearden tore through the antiseptic office suites like a bull rider. He carried a swagger stick, and he was on a high, a colleague remembered. He talked to everyone, including the stiff peacock, General Akhtar, the Pakistani intelligence chief, as if they were his personal guests at a Texas keg party. He buttonholed Soviet diplomats at polite receptions and quoted Shakespeare as Afghan policy. Speak not of the manner of your leaving, but leave at once. At regional conferences for CIA chiefs of station, Bearden would brag, All of you guys out there, you try to recruit Soviets. Me? I just kill them. If he got angry at Pakistani intelligence over some problem in the weapons pipeline, he would refuse to take General Akhtar's calls for a week just to let him stew. Still, he became a favorite of some Pakistani officers. When his family was snowed in on vacation, the Pakistani Air Force flew in a C-130 to get them out. Bearden cultivated an impression that the conspiracy-minded Pakistani elite were inclined toward anyway, that the CIA was the real power in the American government. Inside the walled U.S. Embassy compound, Bearden's colleagues noted the small touches. The diplomatic license plate on his official car ended with 01, the number usually reserved for the ambassador. Bearden tried to tame the huge flow of material and money coming to Pakistan. Along the northern border between Pakistan and China, Bearden helped arrange the truck transport of hundreds of mules being sold to the CIA by the Chinese communists for use in smuggling guns that would be fired against Soviet communists. Because there weren't enough mules, Bearden ordered animals by ship from as far away as Texas and Djibouti. When a freighter from Djibouti went missing on the high seas, Bearden papered the world for several weeks with urgent classified cables headlined, Ship of Mules. The Islamabad station had warned in a broad July assessment cable that the pace of Mujahideen attacks appeared to be slowing under the relentless helicopter assaults mounted by Soviet special forces, especially along the Pakistani border. Langley analysts and Pakistani generals shared a fear in the summer of 1986 that the new Soviet assault tactics might be tipping the war's balance against the CIA-backed rebels. On September 26, 1986, about 2 months after Bearden's arrival, the balance began to tip back. Crouching in scrub rocks on a barren plain near the Jalalabad airport in eastern Afghanistan, just 2 hours' drive from Peshawar, a commander named Engineer Ghaffar, the Forgiver, and two bearded colleagues lifted onto their shoulders the first of a new type of anti-aircraft weapon supplied to the rebels by the CIA. Powered by batteries and guided by the most effective portable heat-seeking system yet invented, the Stinger weapon was an American-made marvel of modern frontline arsenals. Its infrared tracking system made it impervious to countermeasures normally taken by Soviet pilots. A military engineer trained in the Soviet Union, Ghaffar had been selected by Pakistani intelligence to attempt the first Stinger mission, and he had trained in secret at an ISI compound near Rawalpindi. 8 Soviet Army MiG-24D helicopter gunships approached the Jalalabad runway. Ghaffar sighted his missile, pushed its black rubber uncage button on the grip stock, and pulled the trigger. His first shot pinged, misfired, and rattled in the rocks a few hundred yards away. But another flashed across the plain and smashed into a helicopter, destroying it in a fireball. More missiles flew in rapid succession, and two other helicopters fell, killing their Russian crews. Akhtar called Bearden as soon as he received the radio report. The station chief sent a cable to Langley describing the strikes, but warned there was no confirmation. A day later, the Islamabad embassy's communications vault rattled with a startling reply. By sheer coincidence, a U.S. KH-11 spy satellite had been passing overhead, taking routine pictures of the Afghan battlefield. The satellite had transmitted a clear photo of the Jalalabad airport, showing three charred balls of steel scrap, formerly helicopters, lying side by side across an active runway. The incoming cable from Langley was triumphant. Satellite imagery confirms three kills at Jalalabad as reported. Please pass our congratulations for a job well done. The CIA had learned years before that Ronald Reagan was not much of a reader. Dense, detailed briefings about global affairs rarely reached his desk. But Reagan loved movies. Casey encouraged his colleagues to distill important intelligence so the president could watch it on a movie screen. Before Reagan met visiting heads of state, he would sometimes screen a short CIA-produced classified bio movie about his visitor. Thinking partly of its most important customer, the CIA had equipped Engineer Ghaffar's team with a Sony video camera to record the Stinger's debut. "Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!" the shooters cried as they fired the Afghan War's first Stingers. By the time Ghaffar had hit the third helicopter, the videotape looked like some kid at a football game, as Bearden later described it. Everybody is jumping up and down. All you're getting is people jumping up and down and seeing the earth kind of go back and forth. The tape's last sequence showed Ghaffar's crew unloading Kalashnikov rounds into the crumpled corpses of the Soviet crew as they lay sprawled on the Jalalabad tarmac. Within weeks, the highly classified video had been ferried from Islamabad. President Reagan screened it at the White House. As the tape and the KH-11 satellite pictures were passed around the old executive office building and shared with a few members of Congress, a triumphal buzz of excitement spread in Washington. The decision to supply Stingers had been made against the CIA's initial advice. Not long after National Security Decision Directive 166 took force, members of the Interagency Group on Afghanistan had begun to push for the missiles, arguing that they could repulse the Spetsnaz's helicopter assault tactics. Introducing a made-in-the-USA weapon on the Afghan battlefield would hand the Soviets a propaganda victory, the CIA's Near East Division feared. But Morton Abramowitz, the State Department's intelligence director, backed the idea. After a long and emotional debate, the CIA capitulated. Even then, months of secret negotiations were required with the Chinese and with Pakistani President Zia before all were satisfied that the risks of Soviet retaliation were worth bearing. Soon after Ghaffar's video trailer was screened at the White House, dozens of Mujahideen commanders in eastern Afghanistan began to launch Stingers at Soviet helicopters and lumbering transport planes, with devastating results. Apprehensive Russian and Afghan crews ascended as often as possible above the Stinger's effective ceiling of about 12,500 feet, severely diminishing their ability to carry out low-flying attack raids. Soviet forces stopped evacuating the wounded by helicopter, demoralizing frontline officers. Within months, Bearden had cabled Langley to declare that Stingers had become the war's most significant battlefield development. If diverted from Afghanistan, a Stinger could easily be used as a terrorist weapon against passenger aircraft, the agency warned. Their spread in Afghanistan added urgency to the CIA's need for agents to monitor rebel commanders and Pakistani intelligence. What if Hekmatyar sold Stingers to terrorist groups? What if the missiles were stolen? How would the CIA even know? The agency needed more of its own reporting sources. Even by its own rich standards, the jihad was now swimming in money. Congress secretly allocated about $470 million in U.S. funding for Afghan covert action in fiscal year 1986, and then upped that to about $630 million in fiscal 1987, not counting the matching funds from Saudi Arabia. With support from headquarters, Bearden expanded the CIA's unilateral recruitment of independent Afghan agents and commanders without the involvement of Pakistani intelligence. The money needed for such a payroll amounted to crumbs in comparison to the new budgets. The recruited commanders were asked to help the CIA keep track of weapons handouts, Pakistani corruption, and battlefield developments. The payroll had several tiers. A regional commander might draw an agency retainer of $20,000 or $25,000 a month in cash. A somewhat more influential leader might draw $50,000 a month. A commander with influence over one or more provinces might receive $100,000 monthly, sometimes more. An effective commander used these retainers not solely to enrich himself, but to hold together clan or volunteer militias that required salaries, travel expenses, and support for families that often lived in squalid refugee camps. Abdul Haq remained on the CIA's unilateral payroll. The CIA also continued to deliver payments and supplies directly to Ahmed Shah Massoud. Unilateral CIA assistance had first been delivered to Massoud in 1984. The CIA later sent in secure communications sets allowing Massoud to interact with dispersed commanders and allies in Peshawar without fear of Soviet interception. Bearden's Islamabad station expressed skepticism about Massoud. Some people involved thought it might be in part because of the testosterone-fed jockeying between the CIA and the British. Massoud was a British favorite, therefore the CIA didn't like him much. Then, too, there was a residue of distrust dating to the truce deals that Massoud had cut with Soviet forces in 1983. Bearden told colleagues that he respected Massoud's track record as a fighter, but saw Massoud already positioning himself to take power in post-war Kabul, hoarding supplies and limiting operations.
"Ahmed, I know what you're doing, and I don't blame you, but don't do it on my nickel," was the thrust of Bearden's message.
A CIA officer at Langley told a French counterpart, referring to the agency's support for Hekmatyar, "Gulbuddin is not as bad as you fear, and Massoud is not as good as you hope." The CIA's network of Afghan unilaterals swelled to about 4 dozen paid commanders and agents. That was a large number of running contacts to keep hidden for long from Pakistani intelligence, given that CIA case officers had to meet regularly with their clients. ISI routinely surveilled known CIA case officers, even in the midst of a nominally friendly liaison. Practicing standard tradecraft, the Islamabad station organized its Afghan network so that no one CIA officer, not even Bearden, knew the real names of every agent in the system. Commanders on retainer were given cryptonyms for cabling purposes. Massoud was too well known to be hidden behind code names, but even so, knowledge of that liaison within the U.S. Embassy was limited very tightly. Because of the large sums of dollars now arriving, the Islamabad station tried to streamline its cash distributions to minimize the number of times when American officers had to travel on Pakistani roads carrying fortunes worthy of robbery and murder. The agency began to use electronic transfers for its subsidies to Pakistani intelligence, routing money through the Pakistan Ministry of Finance. To deliver cash to commanders, the CIA also began to use the Hawala system, an informal banking network in the Middle East and South Asia that permits an individual to send money to a small trading stall in, say, Karachi, for instant delivery to a named recipient hundreds or thousands of miles away. Especially after the Iran-Contra scandal erupted in Washington late in 1986, the Islamabad station took great pains to document every transfer. Given the amounts now involved, it was as easy to misplace $3 million or $4 million as it was to leave your keys on your desk. Most of the reporting that began to flow from the unilateral agents focused on the impact of stingers, weapons deliveries, and propaganda campaigns. But for the first time came complaints from some Afghan fighters to the CIA about a rising force in their jihad, Arab volunteers. Thousands of them were arriving in Afghanistan. Afghan commanders would send out notes to the Islamabad station, sometimes with pictures showing a truckload of Arab jihad fighters driving through their territory. The Afghans called them Wahhabis because of their adherence to rigid Saudi Islamic doctrine banning adornment and the worship of shrines. Early on, some Afghan fighters clashed with Arab jihadists over the issue of decorated graves. Most Afghan mujahideen buried their dead in rough dirt and stone graves marked by green flags and modest adornments, following Sufi-influenced traditions. Echoing the methods of the Saudi Ikhwan near Jeddah more than half a century earlier, the Wahhabis swept through and tore down these markers, proclaiming that they encouraged the worship of false idols. In at least a few cases, the Afghans attacked and killed these Arab graveyard raiders. Bearden recalled the thrust of the very early reports arriving from Afghan commanders in the field. "They say we are dumb, and we do not know the Quran, and they are more trouble than they are ever going to be worth." Osama bin Laden moved his household. He had married and fathered his first children. From Saudi Arabia to Peshawar, around the same time that Milton Bearden arrived in Islamabad as CIA station chief. He rented a two-story compound in a quiet, relatively prosperous, pine-tree-cooled section of the city called University Town, where charities, Western aid groups, diplomats, Arab preachers, and wealthy Afghan exiles all lived as uneasy neighbors in walled-off villas. From his regular visits, his work with Ahmed Badib and Saudi intelligence, his patronage of Arab charities, and his importation of bulldozers and other construction equipment, bin Laden was already a well-known figure among Muslim Brotherhood-connected Afghan rebels. He was closest to Hekmatyar and Sayaf. His acquaintances in Peshawar viewed bin Laden as a young, sweet-tempered, soft-mannered, and above all, fabulously wealthy patron of worthy jihad causes. He was a rising young sheikh, not much of an orator, but a smiling visitor to the hospitals and orphanages, and, increasingly, an important discussion group member in Peshawar's radical Arab circles. Bin Laden rode horses for pleasure, sometimes in the eastern tribal frontier, but for the most part his was a tea-pouring, meeting-oriented life in damp concrete houses where cushioned-ringed reception rooms would fill with visiting Kuwaiti merchants and Syrian professors of Islamic law. Days would drift by in loose debates, fatwa, religious edict, drafting, humanitarian project development, a shifting mix of engineering, philanthropy, and theology. "He speaks like a university professor," remembered an Arab journalist who met with bin Laden frequently in Peshawar. "We will do this, we will do that. Like he is at the head of the table of the political committee." His quiet style was unusual. "He is not your typical Arabic popular speaker." Peshawar by late 1986 was a city of makeshift warehouses and charities, swelling and bursting from the money, food, trucks, mules, and medicine being shipped to the Afghan frontier in quantities double and triple those of 6 months before. The humanitarian aspects of the jihad were expanding as rapidly as the military campaign. In part, this was a result of National Security Decision Directive 166, but in addition, United Nations agencies, European charities such as Oxfam, proselytizing Christian missionaries, and government relief agencies such as USAID had all come swarming into Peshawar after 1985 to build hospitals, schools, feeding stations, clinics, and cross-border ambulance services, much of it paid for by the American government. These projects operated on an unprecedented scale. One University of Nebraska-run school program worked at 1,300 sites inside Afghanistan. In one dusty university town compound, profane, hard-traveled UN food specialists might be tossing sacks of seed onto blue flag trucks, while neighboring American Baptist missionaries sat on wooden benches reading to Afghan children in English from the New Testament, while over the next wall, bearded young volunteers from the Persian Gulf bent toward Mecca in chanted prayer. Operating in self-imposed isolation, major Saudi Arabian charities and such organizations as the Saudi Red Crescent, the World Muslim League, the Kuwaiti Red Crescent, and the International Islamic Relief Organization set up their own offices in Peshawar. Funded in ever-rising amounts by Saudi intelligence and annual zakat contributions from mosques and wealthy individuals, they too built hospitals, clinics, schools, feeding stations, and battlefield medic services. European charities such as Médecins Sans Frontières recruited volunteer surgeons from Brussels and Paris for short rotations to treat Mujahideen victims in Peshawar, and Islamic charities began to recruit doctors from Cairo, Amman, Tunis, and Algiers for volunteer tours. Since the Muslim Brotherhood had a strong presence in the Arab professional classes, especially among Egyptian doctors and lawyers, the recruitment network for humanitarian volunteer work became intertwined with the political religious networks that raised money and guns for the Islamist Afghan leaders, such as Hekmatyar and Sayaf. Typical of the Brotherhood recruited volunteers was Ayman al-Zawahiri, a young doctor, scion of a wealthy Egyptian family long active in the Islamist movement. Al-Zawahiri had been imprisoned in Cairo during the early 1980s for activity on the edges of the plot to assassinate Anwar Sadat. After his release, he found his way via the Brotherhood's Islamic Medical Society to Peshawar, volunteering as a doctor at the Kuwaiti-funded Al-Hilal Hospital on the Afghan frontier.
"I saw this as an opportunity to get to know one of the arenas of jihad that might be a tributary and a base for jihad in Egypt and the Arab region," al-Zawahiri recalled.
An Arab snob of sorts, he saw Egypt as
the heart of the Islamic world, where the basic battle of Islam was being fought. But to prevail back home, a jihadist movement needs an arena that would act like an incubator, where its seeds would grow and where it can acquire practical experience in combat, politics, and organizational matters.
Peshawar seemed to him such a place. Al-Zawahiri settled there in 1986. Abdullah Azam was by far the best-known Arab Islamist in Peshawar at the time bin Laden and al-Zawahiri took up residence. He helped run a council of Peshawar's Arab and Islamic charities. Born in a village near the West Bank city of Jenin, Azam earned a doctorate in Islamic law from Al-Azhar University in Cairo during the 1970s. He became close to the Egyptian exile Muhammad Qutb and began to preach and adapt the radical jihadist doctrines of Qutb's deceased brother. After teaching in Jeddah during the late 1970s, he transferred as a lecturer to the New Islamic University in Islamabad, down the hill from Qaid-e-Azam's campus. In 1984, he moved down the Grand Trunk Road to Peshawar. The title of the new humanitarian organization Azam founded that year, the Office of Services, signaled his own thinking about the Afghan jihad. He wanted mainly to aid the Afghans. He traveled the Persian Gulf and lectured at Friday prayers in wealthy mosques from Jeddah to Kuwait City, and as the charitable funds flowed, he used them to provide medical and relief services as well as military support. Bin Laden, his former pupil in Jeddah, became an important source of money and then an operations partner beginning in 1984. Together, they recruited other volunteers from across the Arab world. Azam announced that bin Laden would pay the expenses, about $300 per month, of any Arab who wanted to fight on Afghanistan's battlefields. In 1986, they opened their first office in the United States amid the large Arab community in Tucson, Arizona. Overall, the U.S. government looked favorably on the Arab recruitment drives. An international brigade of volunteers, modeled on the international socialist volunteers who had joined the Spanish Civil War against Franco during the 1930s, would provide a way to broaden the formal coalition of nations involved in the anti-Soviet jihad, this argument went. As more and more Arabs arrived in Pakistan during 1985 and 1986, the CIA examined ways to increase their participation, then Deputy CIA Director Robert Gates recalled. An Afghan specialist in the State Department's Intelligence Bureau argued that we should try and coordinate with them. The idea was not to see them as the enemy. But the proposals never moved beyond the talking stage. At the Islamabad station, Milt Bearden felt that bin Laden himself actually did some very good things, as Bearden recalled it. He put a lot of money in a lot of the right places in Afghanistan. Bin Laden was not regarded as someone who was anti-American. The CIA did receive negative reports about the Arab volunteers from its Afghan agent network and from Western and Christian aid organizations. Their complaints coursed through the CIA and State Department cabling system, but the issue was only an occasional subject for reporting and analysis. No policy or action plan was ever developed.
Abdullah Azam preached stridently against the United States. He would soon help found Hamas. Prince Turki al-Faisal and Saudi intelligence became important supporters. Azam circulated in a world apart from the official Americans in Pakistan. Even relatively neutral European aid workers living in Peshawar had only sporadic contact with him. By the summer of 1986, small signs of a